Welcome to Conversations with Contemporary Artists. Tonight we are pleased to have British filmmaker Isaac Julian presenting. Tonight's program would not have been possible without the expertise and hard work of Laura Bayless, assistant educator in the Department of Education, as well as Mark Mayer, the year-long intern. The Department of Education would also like to thank the Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art, the Edward John Noble Foundation, and the Leo and Julia Forsheimer Foundation for their generous support of this program. Before Sally Berger, who is assistant curator in the Department of Film and Media, introduces Isaac, I just want to mention two upcoming programs that you might want to put on your calendars. December 3rd, there's a program entitled Decadence, Redon and Fantasy Ecla Poetry and Music. And at that program, Bill T. Jones, Richard Howard, and Mary Jo Bang will read selections from Baudelaire, Poe, and Huysmans, and Juilliard students will perform decadent music. We're hoping there will be some decadence as well. December 16th, John Lasseter, who's the founding member of Pixar Animation Studios, will discuss the creative process at Pixar, and that will definitely be a very interesting evening. So without further ado, Sally Berger will introduce Isaac Julian.
Thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you, Isaac, for being here. Isaac Julian is an internationally recognized artist, writer, teacher, and scholar. He's based in London, where he was born, and graduated in 1984 from St. Martin's School of Art, where he studied painting and fine art film. Following his schooling, Isaac Julian became a founding member of the pioneering film and video collective Black Workshop Sankofa that made radical dramas for film and television. He quickly became part of the first new wave of Black British independent filmmakers, winning critical acclaim and the Cannes Film Festival's Critics Week Prize for his first feature film, Young Soul Rebels, in 1991. Isaac's films also include Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Mask in 1995, and the critically acclaimed documentary on Langston Hughes, Looking for Langston, made in 1989. He is the co-founder of Normal Films, which was started in the early 90s, with writer-producer Mark Nash, filmmaker Steve McLean, and Jimmy Somerville. Isaac Julian has been working in media installation as well since the early 1990s. He is recognized for bringing an experimental film sensibility to media installation work, as well as innovatively approaching sensuality, eroticism, aestheticism, and identity-related issues throughout his work. He was nominated for the Turner Prize in 2001 for the film installations The Long Road to Mazatlan, made in collaboration with Javier de Frutos, and Vagabondia, which was made in 2000. And The Long Road to Mazatlan came out in 1999. His other media installations include Fantôme Creole, which is the most recent, or 2005, unless you, I'm sure you've got something else on your burner. Isaac is very busy. Baltimore, 2003, and Paradise Omeros in 2002. Isaac was visiting lecturer at Harvard University School of African American and Visual Environmental Studies and the Whitney Museum of American Art's Independent Study Program. He is a research fellow at Goldsmiths University, and in 2001 was the recipient of the MIT Eugene McDermott Award in the Arts. In 2003, he won the Grand Jury Prize at the Kunstfilm in Cologne for his single-screen version of Baltimore. So we were just kind of laughing at his presentation of his playful and historically insightful badass cinema, which he presented as part of a Video Viewpoints for the Department of Film and Media when we were in transition and based at the Gramercy Theater. And that was in 2003. At the same time, he was premiering an installation in New York at the Bowen Foundation. So I'm very happy to introduce Isaac tonight, this preeminent filmmaker and artist who's really broken a lot of new ground in many ways. He has a lot of courage and is willing to go into territory that really no one else has done. So it's really a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sally, for your very kind introduction. And it's a great pleasure to be here back in New York and to show a few clips and to actually have a conversation, because this is meant to be conversational. So rather than to present a paper or to sort of be very thoracicist or academic, really what I want to do is to have a conversation and for you to feel kind of, you know, free or flexible enough to ask questions whenever you'd like. So this is a general, kind of much more sort of open, discursive event than other presentations. And what I was going to do was basically to, in a sense, put on my hat as a flaneur, as someone who is a sort of nomadic character who goes through several different locations and walks. And the first two films which I'd like to show, one a film that, which I made in 1989 called Looking for Langston, which you may be familiar with, and the other, Baltimore, a film video installation which I showed at Metro Pictures in 2003 here in New York. But actually, what I'm going to show you here is a single screen version. And the things for me which come to mind when I show these two clips are really the museum as this space and location where I'm very much, in a prophetic sense, in Looking for Langston, constructing a world, looking at New York, looking at black artists in the 20s and in the 30s, and concentrating on Langston Hughes. Now, Langston Hughes, as you know, was the kind of very important poet. He was head of the Harlem Renaissance, the kind of black arts movement, which in a way created a revolution in the beginning of the century. And in a sense, what we have in crystallized in Langston Hughes is this fantastic poet. And of course, I have been the sort of Amphul Tarib that I was then. From the other side of the Atlantic, made this film, which when it showed at the New York Film Festival, the Langston Hughes estate wanted to close the film festival down because of it. So you can imagine how happy they were about that. But basically, this piece of work, when it was shown, the sound had to be taken down from two sections of the film in the beginning and the end, because the two sections had Langston Hughes reciting a poem. And because the two sections constituted him, as it were, kind of reciting a whole poem, then I was not able to have fair usage. And so that sort of contradicted the sort of use of the poem, and so therefore the Hughes estate sort of had me, as it were. And the sound was turned down, that caused a sensation and an infamous sort of entry, as it were, into the New York art world. And I remember Art Forum, Greg Tate writing a review about it that year, and then subsequently the film was shown at the Bleecker Street Cinema and was shown in different sort of cities. It was shown at the Sundance Film Festival, the New York Film Festival, and then later on was released on DVD, and I think it was shown in lots of universities, and so therefore it became shown as a piece of work. But what I wanted to do is to show you this first clip, because in a way it's very much sort of concentrating on the sort of representation of artists. And actually I spent lots of time here in 1987 at MoMA in the archive department looking for moving images of artists at work. And MoMA had a fantastic print of St. Louis Blues. And also they were very helpful in leading me to sort of look at some other archive which I was able to utilize in the clip which I'm going to show you next. So if we could have the first clip from Looking for Langston, please. Thank you. And of course, there should be sound. That was a repeat of the New York Film Festival screening.
Being photographed by Carl Van Vechten, staging the first production of Baldwin's The Amen Corner at Howard University, straightening Harold Jackman's tie, not caring much for County Cullen's looks, hunting dark meat with Ordinum in Harlem, being loved. What probably seemed obvious to him then would not make itself clear to me for years. We were linked by our homosexual desires. Eventually, I discovered that they had broken a number of rules about the Negro by writing at all. But before I came to terms with that, I would have to learn something about the terms they had set for themselves and others had set for them. Not to discuss the moral significance of County Cullen, Langston Hughes, Alan Locke, choosing in the main others of their kind to love, is to emasculate and embalm their society as a whole. It erases the image of the two-colored sissies kissing and producing poems and paintings for and about each other. And finally, it undermines, as so much of America's recorded history does, whenever it attempts to reconcile itself to that enigma known as the Negro. The dismissal of nearly everything that does not make it white. History as the smiler with the knife.
Streets, oh little breath of oblivion that is night. A city building to a mother's song, a city dreaming to a lullaby. reach up your hand, dark boy, and take a star out of the little breath of oblivion that is night. Take just one.
We end it. And that makes me feel very nostalgic when I see that film. And obviously, I spoke about the idea of this sort of archival sort of interest in the museum, and also obviously the sort of nature and autonomy of the black artist. And obviously, in the piece which you've just seen, there is this, if you like, opening which takes place in New York in the 30s at an art gallery, and we see African American artists and their patrons, whilst Hall reads a verse from Chaucer, "History, the smile of the knife hidden under the cloak." And I think, obviously, in that I was alluding to my suspicion of the art world and the possible dangers of patronage for black and queer artists. And I think that's indeed something that's very sort of ironic and, in a sense, I think an enigma in relationship to my own practice, because in a very prophetic sense, it would be indeed the museum and the gallery where I would, as it were, be making a number of my experimental investigations rather than in cinema proper. And of course, the museum becomes a site which I visited time and time again in the 93 film The Attendant, also in a film which I made called Vagabondia, which was shot at the John Soane Museum in 2000. And then Baltimore, where I returned to America, because of course that's another favorite subject really of mine. And Baltimore was a piece of work which I was approached by a fantastic sort of museum called The Contemporary, which was originally called The Museum Without Walls. Lisa Corrin had done a very important project with Fred Wilson called Mind in the Museum. And I thought to myself, my God, you know, what Fred did was so amazing and so fantastic. If I was going to make a piece of work in Baltimore, you know, I really would have to think very carefully about what I would do, because he had sort of, in a way, made such a fantastic contribution. And of course, I didn't want to falter, as it were, in that piece of work. And over the period of 2 years, I was invited to Baltimore. I was teaching at Harvard at the time, and several kind of curators actually sort of vacated the position while I was actually attempting to make my research for the piece. And eventually, one day, I was given a tour by a sort of, you could call him a sort of ethnographer, and it was a tour of Black Baltimore, and basically he invited me to this museum called the Great Blacks and Wax Museum. And at first I thought, this really can't be true that it's a Great Blacks and Wax Museum. And of course, I came across sort of this amazing sort of institution, and immediately I just thought, my God, it's a Thomas Hersham installation. You know, I mean, if Thomas Hersham had seen this space, you know, it would have been where he would have decided to have made his new piece. But also, I think one of the amazing things about it was really because I had been approached by the Waters Museum to make a piece of work after they saw Vagabondia, and they loved Vagabondia because it was very kind of 18th century and very velvety, and it was very kind of museum-like. And I thought, I can't do another piece like that. You know, it would have to be different. And there, in this museum, were these really very interesting kind of black waxworks. And I thought about waxworks and artworks and having this seance that could be possible if one was to bring these two different archives together. And so it was really an attempt to basically think about these two different archives, these two versions of sort of memorialization, and then thinking about the ways in which, in my sort of school lessons at Harvard, students sort of saying, we'd really like to see some Quentin Tarantino films. You know, you show us these films, you know, which are from Africa and these other places, but this is what we really, really want to see. And I thought, God, what am I going to do? And basically, I came up with the idea to teach a course, which was called, it was called something like Black Cinema? And the subtitle was Blaxploitation to Quentin Tarantino. So I thought I could, and there was some brilliant writing that had begun to develop in cinema studies. One woman wrote this fantastic book on, her name is called Sharon Willis, and it was on masculinity and sort of Tarantino, and it was really very, very theoretical, but really very interesting. So basically, after teaching this course, I thought, well, it'd be great to actually make a documentary about it, because in a way, teaching is a form of research. And basically, I was approached by Colin McCabe, who had been making a number of documentaries for the Independent Film Channel, and basically he sort of said, well, why don't we try to do it? And they went to the Cannes Film Festival, met up with Quentin Tarantino. Quentin Tarantino said he'd really like to do the project, and then from there, we were able to get Samuel Jackson and Pam Grier, and we were able to bring all these different characters together to tell this story of black action films. But after making that piece of work, I kind of came across Melvin Van Peebles. And Melvin Van Peebles, in a sense, is a really very interesting artist and filmmaker. And he, in fact, I think, made this really quite amazing film, Sweet Sweet Back's Badass Song. All my students were horrified by it, because it has some very sort of intense scenes in it, and basically kind of, I think, at the same time, they really admired that film. They really admired Melvin Van Peebles, and of course, Melvin Van Peebles is a sort of icon. And there were some very interesting sort of essays which were written about that film as well. And one of the things which developed really from making the film was I invited Melvin in a way to collaborate with me to make this piece of work. And he basically, I wanted to make a wax work of him. And he knew someone who made wax figures, and very good ones, better than the ones in the Great Blackstone Wax Museum. And basically, kind of, it was also David Nugent, who was a sort of teaching assistant of mine sitting just over there. He said to me, Isa, if you want to do this project, you really have to sort of get Melvin, and you really have to sort of, you know, get this work going, you know. So he was also pushing me as well, because I was very exhausted. I'd just done Paradise Omeros for Documentary 11, and I was teaching at Harvard, and I thought, well, can I do this? And he was very instrumental as well. And also, lucky for me, I got this sort of, fellowship with iBeam, where they did these special effects. And so I thought it'd be fantastic to think about doing special effects, and, you know, and of course it was very odd because I've never done that sort of work before. And what was very ironic about it was making the wax work of Melvin Van Peebles, and then having your main protagonist, Vanessa Mari, who plays a cyborg, taking photographs of her and then animating her a bit like a model. Which was like a different, it was like a virtual waxwork, so to speak, to allow us to do these special effects. And so, kind of, it was really a very interesting sort of museum walk compared to the one I did in Looking for Langston. And so, what I'd like to do is to show you a clip from Baltimore. And, you know, if you want to ask any questions about it, please do. So, we could show the next piece.
Thank you.
that's it. I mean, so anyway, the thing that I'm really interested about doing this project is that it took a very long time to negotiate all the different sort of, if you like, agreements and contracts and collaborations with the different sort of institutions. But once all of those things were set in play, when we were shooting, I mean, it took about sort of an hour to get everybody out, you know, of the space, because people got so excited by this sort of frisson that got created in this sort of juxtaposition of these different sort of iconic sort of configurations. So I'm going to ask now if you want to ask any questions, because this is meant to be conservational, or I can continue talking. Sure, yes. Well, first of all, you know, we have Metro Pictures here, and I would like to thank them for allowing me to show the piece, you know, because, you know, they were, as it were, brave enough to show the work. And, you know, I think it was really a fantastic sort of opportunity and intervention. But I would say sort of like, you know, that's a very good question, because I think one of the things, for example, in a piece like Baltimore was really trying to think about the archive and really thinking about sort of, and also in looking for Langston, the way they're like two different versions of looking at the archive, you know. So if you look to, if you like, this sort of past, and if you look to kind of the kinds of images that one would find of artists who are black, I mean, when I went to St. Joseph Martin's School of Art, certainly it wasn't something that I was taught. And so there was a sort of desire, if you like, to sort of find out about that world. And so that's always been a sort of fascination, really, for me in terms of America, because obviously, you know, but one of the things that was really very interesting is when I undertook the research looking for Langston was that it was really difficult to get moving images of artists. And so a lot of these films, which are in the clip which I've just shown to you in the first clip, were images which we kind of found through doing about nearly 2 years' work of sort of archiving work. And so what I was really excited about was to sort of basically put these different sort of archives together and then to using reconstruction, which was in a way very much embellished by a sort of homage to silent film of that era and sort of to black and white photography, and then constructing a sort of, if you like, seamless passage from one time to the other. So I'm very interested in time. And I'm very interested in a way, weaving what could be incongruous materials, but sort of making those materials seem like one, so to speak. And so in a piece like Baltimore, there's also that sort of interest, if you like, in sort of looking at sort of one archive, which is the Great Blatt and Wax Museum, and then the Waters Museum, which is another archive, and then bringing that together. And I think one of the things that was really fantastic about the Fred Wilson Mining the Museum project was the way that he was able to sort of mine those spaces and rearticulate them. So it's also about this sort of rearticulation, so expressing something that you feel that's repressed, as it were, and sort of bringing those things to the fore, you know. And so, but there's also this use of colour, there's the sort of idea, there's the painterly interests. There's also the kind of idea of sort of trying to bring together different worlds, so in a way cinema and sort of plastic arts, sculpture, sort of sonic worlds, and to bring all of these into one space. And so kind of that excites me, and also is something which is sort of very, sort of can be challenging as well, you know. So in a way, kind of, I think that sort of one of the impetus, and also the desire to also bring together, I guess, what could be incongruous material and make it seem maybe beautiful. And at the same time, not to sort of, because you're interested in aesthetics, to shy away from subject matter or a political kind of idea that sort of may seem incongruous. Because of course, in an American debate, beauty and sort of politics or beauty and ideas are quite separated. And so I'm very interested in the idea of pulling these two kind of threads, as it were, together in the work. And I think the idea of desire being a central kind of locus, but also drive, if you like, as well. So, are there any other questions? Sure, Dave. That's right, yes. It's an amazing space, absolutely amazing. Well, I must say that this piece of work was storyboarded Baltimore to death, in the sense that basically one was very much sort of involved in working with I-Beam, who were fantastic, but when you do special effects, you have to do so much visual research. You know, we had to photograph the whole of the Peabody kind of interior, absolutely every single inch of it. And then they recreated it in the computer. And then we had to photograph 360 degrees the character Vanessa Myrie. And then that was put into the kind of, if you like, virtual space. And then that's how you was able to animate the jump and all those kinds of things. And so in a sense, sort of what happened with Baltimore is that it was a sort of scripted piece of work. And so in terms of those different, like, when I saw the Peabody Library, first of all, the first thing I thought was like, my God, it's such a find. And then my anxiety, can I film in that space, you know? And so when, and because it was a collaboration between the Waters, the Bats and Wax Museum, and the Peabody, then everybody was very excited about it. But actually nobody had been allowed in that space for about 2 years. And, you know, it's really, you know, sort of a fantasiacal sort of space. I mean, it really is sort of quite an amazing sort of space, really, and that whole area of Baltimore is really very interesting. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay. And are there any other questions? Sure.
What are you working on
now? Well, what I was going to do is show you these two new pieces. And so basically kind of, you know, the piece which I was going to show is True North, and that's a fairly recent project, which was shot in Iceland. And it's a piece of work which basically looks at another American story. It's a story of Matthew Henson. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Matthew Henson, but basically he was the kind of collaborator of Robert E. Peary, who in 1909 basically got to the North Pole first. And there's a sort of controversy around the Peary figure. And I should just say that I was very, very influenced by a book that was written called Gender on Ice, Lisa Bloom, a fantastic book. And in this book, she basically spoke about sort of polar exploration and the whole idea of sort of a certain masculinity and nationhood, and she really broke it down. It's a really fantastic book. And luckily for me, I was able to organize a conference at the MAC in Los Angeles, the Center for Architecture, and to basically have a conference where Jose Minios wrote a text and gave a paper about True North and Lisa Bloom together, and we had a panel, so we were able to talk about all the different questions which came up. But in her research, I mean, it's a real serious kind of study, really, of this history of kind of polar exploration. And she basically talks about the ways in which sort of someone like Peary was very dependent, in fact, on Matthew Henson, and that the fact that, you know, Henson had to amputate nine of Peary's toes during the expedition, and that in some ways he became almost like a dead weight. But it was because of his sort of sponsoring and campaigning that this actual kind of expedition was able to take place. But also, I have to confess, this is all a sort of alibi, really, because one of the things I've always been really fascinated by is snow and ice. And in another kind of time, there were lots of debates about sort of representations of snow and ice. There's also a very kind of, if you like, sort of gay reading around the notion of interracial desire, of someone being a snow queen, someone who might desire, a black person might desire a white person, right? These sort of like very kind of, if you like, interestingly kind of critical and sort of, in a way, quite sort of insightful, but kind of acidic ways of sort of people kind of reading desire, if you like. And so kind of there are all these sorts of ideas which are sort of behind a piece like this, which are sublimated in the work. There's different discourses which developed in cultural studies around the representation of whiteness. Richard Dyer, a well-known film critic, and in a way became a bit like an art historian. He wrote this book called White, which is all about the representation of whiteness. And he looked at Moby Dick and also looked at sort of Caspar, David Friedrich, and that sort of, in a way, representation of whiteness in sort of the history of Western art, etc., etc. And in cinema, he spoke about lighting, which was really very interesting. And I think, in a way, he was responding to a lot of the debates which were taking place in England at the time, which was around the question of racial representation. And I think he felt that, in a way, what was happening, there was a sort of concentration on talking about race, but then you never spoke about whiteness as being raced. I think people do look a bit more in America, but they certainly didn't in Britain. And so basically, sort of, I think it was a sort of attempt to kind of readdress that sort of balance. But in this work, it's really a lot about the sublime. It's really a lot about sort of trying to think about sort of the ways in which, I mean, going to Iceland, which is not really going to the North Pole after all, because I sort of chickened out going there, you know, but I'm mimicking the idea of sort of going to the North Pole in the piece. And you basically have in that piece of work, well, you know, shooting there is not, it's sort of scary, you know, because you have the crevices and you can fall down them. You have lots of people, you have an army of people who are protecting you when you're shooting because it's dangerous and you can't get do this and you can't do that. And it's also very, I mean, maybe when you're skiing you experience it, you know, you go into a whole white kind of fog, you know, and you're skiing and you think, oh my God, you can just fall, you know, you're going to die. Or there are not many people around. There are all these very stupid things. Why do cities occur? Why do human beings huddle together? When you're in the wilderness and you're there filming and you're literally just in this sort of, you know, you really want to get back into your hotel quickly, you know. You really do. You know, it's not fun at all, actually, you know. So the obsession of wanting to film this sort of whiteness and this ice and this snow, and then the actual doing of it, it's really a different... So anyway, so what I'd like to do is just show you a clip from True North, and in it you'll see that it's a free screen piece, and also we can talk about that a little bit, and it's a piece of work that's going to be shown, God, it is next week, in Miami Basel at the Museum of Contemporary Art.
Glory locked in that icy hell, and my soul will never give me peace until it's mine. He wanted me to stop. He wanted me to stop before I got to the power.
Okay, if we can cut it there, please. Yes, and so I mean, one of the main aspects to that piece of work is working from, it's another way of archiving, but it's a different form, where you basically, where you take as it were, a text, the main narration of the text is taken from an interview conducted, I think in 1966, where Robert H. Fowler interviews Matthew Henson, and 30 years after Perry's death, he confesses that there was this sort of fight that they had while they're in the North Pole, and basically, you know, he was really kind of, you know, I mean, it must have been very contentious, because he literally sort of was the only person that had ammunition and had the rifles, and he basically took, you know, all the bullets out and sort of made sure that, you know, that Perry wouldn't be able to, you know, obviously kind of, use violence upon him. So I think there's a certain tension. The translation of that from, say, a male voice into that of a woman who's narrating was really influenced by Lisa Bloom's book and thinking about sort of all the questions that she was posing. And in a way, what I want to do is to contemporize that story for a contemporary audience. So you don't have the real grit and the pain which would really be associated with that sort of endeavor. You know, it is something which is quite aestheticized. It is something which is, in a sense, meditation, a little bit like Looking for Langston was. So I don't know if you have any questions about it. No, it's an interesting question. I mean, the sound, for example, of Looking for Langston existed almost as a soundtrack 2 years before I made or shot anything. So there's a long, extensive sort of sound archival research that project, because I was thinking about the blues, and then I wanted to have, as it were, kind of the ways in which sort of Bessie Smith, it was all, you know, it happened here in MoMA, looking at St. Louis blues, and then realizing that Bessie Smith was really articulating black desire. You know, it wasn't written down, it wasn't theorized in that sort of way, in that academic sense, but it was through song. And so in a way, it was through song then which led to the kind of musicality of Looking for Langston. And so similarly, in a piece like Baltimore, it's really the whole notion of blaxploitation and black action films, and thinking about that, the soundtrack of those, and how you can use that to permeate a space. In a piece like True North, actually, interestingly enough, there's a score that exists for True North that is actually made by a sound artist. His name's called Paul Schutz. And he, this piece of sound sculpture is from a piece of work called Plasma Falls. So actually, I had to pay him, you know, rather a lot, to be able to sort of use that piece of work. And in the end, it was a bit like a collaboration, because he's now working on the performance, which I'm going to be doing for Performer 2007. And we're going to use a much more extended sort of version of that work. But the sculptural nature, the way in which it's in 5.1 surround sound, that whole use of digital sound, if you like, and thinking about all the kind of work that gets made in the sound, you know, because there's people who are doing 3D sound effects, and there's, you know, I mean, I don't know why I'm doing it all, really, but I mean, you know, usually what happens in a museum, they just want the sound to be pulled down, you know, because sound isn't part of the environment of a museum yet. But I think sort of it's sort of something, obviously, with Sonic Process that was at the Pompidou, Sonic Boom that was at the Hayward. You can think about the work of Chris Marker, Christian Marclay, for example, conceptual artist who uses sound quite often in his work. The sonic aspect is really very important as the visualization of the film, and is creating a sort of haptic relationship to the image, a sort of visceral relationship to looking.
That was interesting, the juxtaposition between the documentaries and the video. Is that when you piece like
Well, that's a very interesting question. Because, of course, you know, I've worked as a filmmaker, and basically when you work as a filmmaker, you know, people come into a room, the lights go down, it's silent, and people sit there, and basically that's the experience, and you see it from the beginning, and, you know, there's an end, and you go out, and, you know, so there's a kind of mastery, if you like, in terms of the audience. But I think in terms of video installation, I mean, the interest is, I don't want to pretend that in a piece like True North there's not a beginning. I mean, there is a beginning, you know, and there is an end. And I think, you know, that those sorts of questions are not completely resolved, in effect, in the translation of cinema in the sort of gallery context. But the thing is, I don't really want to duplicate completely the conditions of cinema in a gallery context, because I think there's something that's really quite freeing about a gallery context for showing moving image work. And I think that is that basically the kind of way in which the spectator is able to kind of, in a way, have a much more sort of autonomous relationship to looking, that the fact that the spectator doesn't have to pay money again to see the film, they can sit down and watch it over a period of time, maybe several times. They can come in a certain part of it and go out in a certain part of it. In a way, they participate in making the narrative of the piece. And also, there's a sculptural dimension, and also the kind of, in a way, kind of attention that's given, I think, in a kind of fine art context to the kind of ways in which you might want to install a piece of work, the use of sound. I mean, it's so much more fun than showing in cinema proper. I mean, it really is just so much more creative. It's much more kind of, you know, I think in an art context, there's a sort of, you know, attention to kind of the image. There's an attention to kind of what an artist might want to say, you know. And I think all of that's been lost in cinema, you know. So I think in cinema, I'm not saying that there's not sort of experimental cinema and there's not people who are making works which are sort of really interesting, but I don't think as a sort of culture, you know. I mean, very interestingly enough, I was in Sarajevo recently and with Jeff Gilmore, who's head of the Sundance Film Festival, and we were on the film jury together. I was invited by Agnes B to be on the film jury, and he said to me, well, what is this sort of film thing that's been happening in the art world? Tell me about it. So so he's had a couple of days, 3 days, and I spoke to him about it. And so he said, that's really great. We're going to do this at Sundance. You know, we have to do this at Sundance, you know. We did something with Matthew Barney, but, you know, it wasn't really quite, you know, we need to do something more about this. This is really exciting. This is a world that we need to know about. You know, we should have film installations here. You know, we should show Baltimore at Sundance as a film installation. So I thought, great, you know, kind of let's do it. And then, of course, you get the response. And, you know, the response is, you know, we'd really like to show your work, but do you have a single screen version that we can show? Do we, you know, it'd be really, you know, maybe we can do that installation next year, you know. And I think, in a way, that sort of resistance to kind of what's been happening, that they're sort of interested in it, but then there's not a real commitment. And I think it's that idea of sort of exhibition, you know, that it has to be this sort of singular, sort of almost linear sort of experience, and those modes of presentation and showing things, which I think, you know, and it's interesting, there was a sort of retreat that was organised by this guy called Savi Saviason in Iceland, and sort of Doug Aitken and myself and Matthew Barney and lots of people came, lots of filmmakers came. And basically, we were talking about really this whole kind of predicament and development that's been taking place. But I don't think the questions are resolved. They're sort of quite open-ended, really. I mean, in Documentary 11, you had some people who wanted people to experience the beginning of a piece of work. You know, so in Steve McQueen's installation, you know, you could not walk in the middle of it, you know, and good on him, you know, really. But I think at the same time, for me, I'm not really interested in duplicating those conditions, because if I wanted to do that, then I would show it just in the cinema, you know, and be done with it. So I think there's something that gets offered up in this kind of different kind of reconfiguration, this sort of deterritorialization of film and moving images in that context. Well, if you go to my website, I can give you the coding for it, and you'll see there's a very detailed installation plan of how you showed the worst. But I mean, essentially, it is sort of still, you know, it's a configured 5x4 screens. They're built out. You know, the room should be grey. It should be, you know, it has to be particular projectors. It has to have carpet. It has, you know, it's a commitment. It really is, you know, and, you know, yes. But to be quite honest, it was a mistake, you know, how it developed. You know, it was basically making pieces of work, and then you get a computer program, you know, and like computer programs, you say, let's play, what can we do? You know, and then basically, sort of, we edited a piece of work. I made a piece of work called Free in 1998, and then I did a piece of work which was called, but I've got the title of it. But basically, it was connected to the Free, this piece that I made called Free, which was a sort of dance cinema piece. And really, it was from there, really. And then also, you know, Abigail Gantz, looking at that work and sort of thinking about expanded cinema in the 70s. But I think what you can get is a certain synchronicity with the way in which you're able to edit that you can't get, there have been attempts at that, I think, in experimental and avant-garde cinema, you know, and I guess Abigail Gantz got it, you know, was able to do it to a certain degree, but the way that you can really kind of, in a way, the subjectivity, how that's been inflected by computerization, digitalization, that's different, I think, and the way that you can move connected to the sound, you know, so it's really. And so I just decided to have fun in my older age, you know. I mean, you know, I just felt sort of like that basically making films in the cinema world proper was so, I don't know, there's just something about it. It was just so hard work and boring at times. So I think it was the idea of really being able to kind of, you know, just be creative.
Working with some sense of chronology, some sense of beginning and end. And it would seem that your process is really interested or directed at maybe reading against the grain of the archive, or attempting to chart a different path through it, or attempting somehow to deal with all of that noise, deal with that process of selection. So it's interesting to me that you use digital media, because when I think of digital media, I tend to think of literally a process that collapses noise, that, you know, takes information, turns it into binary code, and allows you to play with it in particular ways. But again, it's a, you know, it's a pre-selected medium. So how do you, I guess my question is really about, what is it about this time-based or the digital media that helps you address issues of chronology and language in reading?
I think sort of brings into the next clip that I wanted to show you, really, that sort of question. But I think sort of in a way, kind of, I think the question of input, I mean, one of the things about, just to carry on in relation to answer the last question about the sort of multi-screen things, is the idea of improvisation, that you can improvise a sort of choreography across space and time. And in a similar sense, although a film like Looking for Langston is highly scripted, there is a space in the sort of montage where you want improvisation to undo things in a particular sense. And so one of the things which I spoke about was the undoing of the kind of archive. And in this sense, I was talking usually about a colonial archive. And in Phantom Afrique, there's this attempt at trying to sort of undo that archive, to read against the grain of it in a different way, and doing that. You use sound, you use kind of all the sonic sort of aspects, you sort of use performance, there's a bricolage approach. There are several different approaches which you're sort of mapping onto one another, hoping to reread things, to rearticulate them, to create a sort of space for something which you thought is repressed or something else.
Finite archive.
Yeah. But I think the thing is, sometimes I think there's a fetishization around technology. I mean, I know that I use technology, but I have to confess I'm the most untechnological person. You know, I mean, like, you know, computers and, you know, the people who I'm working with who, you know, are far more sophisticated than I am at those kinds of things. But I think it's really to do with, like, what the ways of thinking about that technology, which is very kind of connected to old-fashioned things, you know, almost, which is that, well, not to trust new technology, really, you know, that it's not an answer to solving questions as such, that sort of, you know, I can think about Vertov, I can think about sort of, you know, all those very sort of early experiments. I think what happens with new technology is that is a time of experimentation, and so that opens up spaces and ways of thinking about things differently. And so, in a sense, you know, what you got with the VCR and video was 24-hour Psycho, Douglas Gordon's sort of rendition of Psycho, which is slowed down, and then you're able to see something different. What you got with the Porter Pack was Bruce Nahman in the studio, sort of mapping the studio and using performance as a way of recording his movements. And in that sort of invention of new technology, people like Joan Jonas being able to sort of use it in a sculptural formation, using the technology in ways which it wasn't designed for, you know. And the problem with new technology is that it wants to, all the new projectors which get done, they allow you less and less access into how you can manipulate them internally. And for example, Toshi, who shot Baltimore, is taking a course at NYU because he wants to basically get into the camera, you know, because he realizes there's a way in which you can manipulate the camera. And I have to confess that when I shot this last piece, I used digital technology, a digital camera, because I kind of felt, well, digital technology is interesting. I have to confess that I'm biased, I prefer film, but I had to also say that there's something in this technology which is actually really interesting, and it's a damn sight cheaper than sort of using film to shoot things. So I think what I'll do is just show a clip from Phantom Afrique, which is a new piece. I should say that when I showed it recently, this summer in the Pompidou, it was a four-screen piece where I amalgamated sort of elements of True North and the Phantom Afrique, if you like, piece, which I shot in Burkina Faso, Burkina Faso being the head country for cinema in Africa. Its capital, Ouagadougou, has a film festival called Fespaco, which has been running for 30 years. And this is a certain convergence, if you could say, of technology and sort of culture that's occurred in this space. And also, one of the other things about... yes, I'll shut up and show it. Yeah. Yeah. Good idea. Could the sound be a bit louder? Thank you. Okay, that's great, thanks. that's roughly about 14 minutes. Okay, so I think this is really, this is the part where it gets, where it's very open. Yeah, I mean, I think sort of like, you know, as a way of answering that question, I would say that some people have said sort of, well, you know, your work, some of the works are very beautiful, and then I thought about this, and I thought, well, perhaps that's where the sort of querying aesthetics come through, you know, so to speak. But I think, obviously, yes, there is the interest in sort of history, which is more connected to memory, that's not to do with the dominant sort of, you know, kind of hegemony, which becomes part of the national story. So Perry is part of the national story, and of course that wouldn't be very appealing to me as a sort of subject matter. So yes, it is obviously about those spaces or kind of voices that are sort of not sort of, as it were, given the sort of attention that I feel they may deserve. And so, and that goes against the grain of lots of different interests, of course, you know. So in that sense, I, you know, one still wants to remain a sort of Omphal Tarib of sorts. I think there's always a non-neutrality, that no space is kind of neutral. You know, when I used to get funding from television to make films, that basically one had to do with a commission editor. So there's always a form of patronage. There always was someone that was sort of saying, okay, you know, you can have this money, but you better not mess up, or you can, you know, I mean, there's always been sort of a certain amount of control. And I think that the control in the sort of film sort of, I mean, someone looked at Badass Cinema, and I was just in Rochester yesterday, and it was a sort of younger sort of queer student, and they said to me, but Badass Cinema wasn't so queer. I mean, he was kind of saying to me that, you know, it wasn't, you know, the kind of, like, looking for Langston, you know, and I said, well, of course it wasn't, you know, it was an independent film channel, you know, it's not an experimental approach, no, you know, it's sort of, it's fairly straight ahead. I mean, I think it's sort of, and I think the context, there's always a sort of contextual aspect into how you're being commissioned. And, you know, so Looking for Langston comes about, for example, because there's these conditions, there's a political will, there's a whole workshop movement, there's a whole experimentational structure, there's an artisanian space that's being created. And, of course, that withers away because of advertising, because of, you know, the sort of question of globalization, because of the dumbing down of television. And so that's no longer a space, really. And so in a way, I think it's really, you know, where does intelligence lie? You know, and I think sort of, well, to my mind, there's a lot more intelligent people located in some of these spaces than in those other spaces, you know. And that's not to say that's always going to be the case, but I think there's always that, and I think that's the thing that in a way, there's always a negotiation, really. And I think, in a way, that I felt perhaps more autonomy, perhaps, in a sort of art sort of space, actually, when I think about it. But I think, obviously, you know, there are systems, and all the systems have their complexities and they have their limitations, you know, so they're all imperfect. But really, I mean, I think it's always about sort of making interventions into certain spaces and taking that as a space that one doesn't take for granted, necessarily.
One of my favorite films is Darker Shade of Black, and I wonder whether, following this question of political interventions, looking back on that film, do you think it, what impact did it have in terms of a conversation around black music and homophobia?
Well, I have to say that was, for me personally, the experience of making that film was so horrid, and it felt the most uncreative, really, way of making a film. And that was a film that was funded by a BBC Arena arts documentary. And I would say that sort of, you know, in terms of raising a debate, you know, it was a film that wanted to make, it was an intervention, you know, songs that basically say that people should be shot down dead because they're gay are wrong. Like, you know, I don't care who's singing them, do you know what I mean? If it has a good beat, well, you know, of course, you know, one's not going to be too moralistic about it, but basically that was, you know, a number of people got together, you know, myself, Stuart Hall, Paul Gilroy, and we said, we have to make, as sort of intellectuals, some sort of intervention into this debate. You know, and so basically kind of that was the reason for making that film. So in that sense, you know, in relationship to the sort of creative and artistic side, well, you know, well, so what, actually, you know, because actually sometimes it's really important just to make that intervention, you know, so kind of that was the whole point of making that piece of work, you know, whether it's had its resonance, I mean, people can use it in different settings, and in the current debate, which is still an ongoing debate, one of the main things that I felt when I was in Jamaica was that it was a human rights issue, and I'm glad that it's become more of a human rights issue, you know, because obviously that was the real essence of the problem, you know, in a space where people felt that sort of, you know, killing people or murdering them because they were gay was absolutely fine, you know, and it's a very complicated history why that might come about. Yeah, okay. She's sort of me. She's sort of me in a sense, you know. She's sort of she's a viewer and a witness. I see her as a sort of witness, and she's basically sort of in place of a number of different things. In Baltimore, she's a cyborg, and that's the sort of, you know. And she's a sort of amalgamation of Cleopatra Jones and sort of Laura Croft and all those sorts of characters that we're sort of familiarized with. And at the same time, she's enigmatic, and she's not, Melvin Van Peebles doesn't get her, sort of, in the end. So she has her own power, so to speak. So that was important in making a piece of work, like Badass Cinema, where, you know, trying to make some querying of blaxploitation with the independent film channel is not going to work, you know. So in a piece like True North, you know, she has a much more ambiguous character. You know, she is a sort of modern-day Matthew Henson, but she's retracing the steps of Matthew Henson. And I made these references to Gender on Ice and Lisa Bloom's text and all the kind of gendered questions that she brings up, which I find very interesting and pertinent to the characterization. And in a way, in Phantom Afrique, she's not got the same presence, you know, because there's another protagonist, Stephen Galloway, who was a dancer in Ballet Frankfurt, and he, in a sense, has more of a presence in that piece. But nonetheless, she is a sort of witness, And I see, she's a sort of creolized subject, like I am, you know, who's basically going back to this space, going back to Africa, not because she has a romantic idea about Africa as such, not because she thinks she's African, you know, because I think most Africans will look at West Indians or look at, you know, the blacks in diaspora. You know, Burkina Faso has a very specific culture. You know, you can be from West kind of Burkina Faso South, and they're completely different cultures. They have, you know, about 40 languages. So there's no sort of romanticism here, but it's really about witnessing these denationalized, terrorized sort of spaces. And I, you know, and I guess she's a sort of muse, really. Okay, thank you.